Good morning, male rat 13.
Morning, female rat 21.
So, any news?
I think I'm very close to cracking the whole food pellet thing.
Okay, tell me more.
You press twice on the blue lever, then once on the red bar.
I did that, and I got a shock.
No, the shock is once on the blue, twice on the red.
No, see, I got two food pellets when I put my right paw in. I took my right paw out, and then I put my right paw in, and I shook it all about.
No, that's the hokey-pokey fallacy. It's been totally discredited. When you hokey-pokeyed, you happened to hit the right buttons and levers, and you created a false positive pattern recognition.
Dude, that is crazy talk. I totally did that little dance, and I got food.
Why does no other rat understand what I'm saying?
What are you saying?
What I'm saying is that it's bigger than bars and levers and food. I'm the key figure in an ongoing government charade. The plot to conceal the truth about this maze. A conspiracy that reaches into the lives of every rat on this planet. You don't see the pattern, the water bottle, the wheel, the playscape, the shocks, the rewards? You don't see how it's all part of an overarching strategy to... Are you even listening to me?
I put my right paw in, and I turned myself about. Why am I not getting the food?
Because that's the wrong pattern, you imbecile.
Today on the show, our never-ending search for patterns in nature, the cosmos, and human behavior. And now he sees patterns in the clouds telling him to call someone named Noreen. Colin McEnroe.
This is the only show that will be introduced occasionally by rats. All right, so we're going to be talking about patterns today. We're going to talk about ways in which they exist, ways in which we see patterns that aren't really there, ways in which we sometimes fail or have failed historically to see patterns. I won't even try to say detect, to see patterns that were there all the time. We have a lot of different levels that we're going to plumb here, but I mean, I think we have to begin with the idea that it is our natural instinct to try to see patterns, to try, if you look at our creation myth, it begins with God creating order out of chaos. We don't want there to be chaos. We want there to be a certain amount of order. We want to be able to see what's there. It's difficult sometimes, and many times most of us trying to make sense out of reality sound a lot like this guy.
Man, I've got certain information, all right? Certain things have come to light, and, you know... Has it ever occurred to you that instead of, running around blaming me, you know, given the nature of all this new, you know, this could be a lot more complex. I mean, it might not be just such a simple, you know?
Okay, so that might be sort of the classic example of a Dionysian mind trying to make an Apollonian statement. But we do want to understand what the patterns are. So I'm going to begin with Michael Shermer, science writer, historian, founder of the Skeptics Society. He's the author of a dozen books, including the New York Times bestselling The Believing Brain. So Michael Shermer, to a certain degree, we are wired to want to find the pattern, right?
That's correct. Yes, I call us pattern-seeking primates. That's what we do. All animals do it. In fact, the whole idea of association learning, connecting the dots, connecting A to B to C and so on, is to try to find causal links that help us survive. So those that found the links more successfully than others were more likely to procreate, and here we are. So the thought experiment I use is, imagine you're a hominid on the plains of Africa 3.5 million years ago. Your name is Lucy. You're a small brain little hominid, and you hear a rustle in the grass. Is it a dangerous predator, or is it just the wind? So if you assume that the rustle in the grass is a dangerous predator, and it turns out it's just the wind, you've made a type 1 error, a false positive, but no harm. You just become more cautious. You move away, but that's a low energy expenditure, and it doesn't cost much. On the other hand, if you assume that the rustle in the grass is just the wind, and it turns out it's a dangerous predator, you're lunch. You've just been given a Darwin Award for taking yourself out of the gene pool early before reproducing. So my argument is that natural selection selected brains that are more likely to err one way than the other. That is, assume that most rustles in the grass are dangerous predators and not the wind, just in case, on that cost-benefit analysis format. And so that's why we tend to believe weird things, as I like to say. It's not that people are ignorant or stupid or uneducated. It's that our brains just tend to believe practically everything we see or hear. And then to then become skeptical takes an extra step of cognition that requires effort.
You know, back to that predator example, too, there's a lot of things about our wiring that sort of make it work that way well for us, too. Like we've discovered that our brains count proportionally and logarithmically. Like, our brains are wired to understand that the difference between one and two predators, one and two lions, is much more significant than the difference between 11 and 12 lions. You know, there's just sort of ways in which our brains really want to help us with these kinds of patterns and the significance of these patterns. Also with us is John Briggs. John Briggs is in the studio with me. He's a professor of English in the department at Western Connecticut State University. He's the author of Fractals, The Patterns of Chaos and the Turbulent Mirror. We're going to, later in the show, talk a lot about fractals and chaos theory and how it turns up here. But John Briggs, I think it's worth bringing it up kind of at the beginning, too, and saying one of the differences as we sort of look at this changing structure of understanding of reality is new ways of thinking about patterns, things that we might have assumed weren't patterns are patterns, and ways in which we assumed that we could detect patterns may have turned out to be situations in which we kind of had over-controlled and kind of sucked all the chaos and entropy out of a much more complicated situation.
Yeah, one way to think about it is our brain and our nervous system has many pattern recognition logarithms or algorithms and feature detectors. What Michael was talking about earlier, you could also say that those patterns become stereotypes. So one of the characteristics of our pattern-seeking brains is that they tend to by nature simplify the world, so that we can detect whether what's rustling in the bushes or is a wind or a lion or something dangerous. So the downside of creating these in memory. These patterns in memory, and some of the patterns are formed in the brain through evolution that has actually put them in the brain. There's a study back in the 1950s that we have in our cerebral, in our occipital cortex, cells that will recognize orientation of light. So that's a built-in recognition of certain signals coming in from the outside. Other patterns we learn through acculturation. And when we have those patterns, they become stereotypes that have a downside. So we operate a lot in the world through stereotypes, which are belief systems. And it's one of the reasons, for example, that individuals may indicate a prejudicial stereotype with regard to race, but they may have friends of that race that they don't apply the stereotype to because they have seen the nuances in the stereotype. So I guess my message would be that pattern recognition often operates on a gross simplification of reality.
Well, and before we'll come to that in a little bit more in the second and third segments of the show. But Michael Shermer, it's not just us. It's not just Homo sapiens, right? I mean, animals can confuse themselves about patterns too. Talk about the pigeons, the B.F. Skinner box pigeons.
Yes. Well, you open with the little rats. Yeah. Of course, it's the same thing with pigeons or any organism. Anything with a brain is going to make connections between things. That's one of the things neurons do. So the example I use in the believing brain is my own research in a Skinnerian lab in which we train pigeons to peck at keys and rats to press bars and so on. And they were trying to figure out, just like your fun example, little rats were, what the pattern is in order to get a reinforcement. So we know how that works, that dopamine is released in the brain. It feels good. It's nice to get a reinforcement. And so you try to find the pattern. And in our case, it turns out if you give them no particular pattern to find, that is, you just randomly reinforce them, their behavior, they will still find a pattern anyway. They will you know, turn two times to the left and once to the right and touch the wing on the left wall of the cage and so on. They'll find a pattern, and that's called superstition. That's called magical thinking. Skinner discovered that in the 50s. It's been replicated many times since. But you don't have to look at pigeons. You can just go to Las Vegas or Atlantic City and see the same process of people sitting there at slot machines trying to figure out the pattern. And, of course, the slot machine owners know this, and they reward them just enough to keep them sitting there, but not so much that they can actually win in the long run. You will lose. And so that's, that process of magical thinking, pattern-seeking behavior that leads to superstitions, that is why people believe all these sorts of things, conspiracy theories and even many religious beliefs. Like in my analogy of the hominid on the plains of Africa, you hear the rustle in the grass. What's the difference between, the wind and a dangerous predator? The wind is an inanimate force. A dangerous predator is an agent. So I call this agenticity, the tendency to find hidden agents operating everywhere. And that's the basis of animism and spiritualism and polytheism and monotheism, the idea that there's angels and gods and demons and secret conspiracies and cabals operating behind the scenes, pulling the strings, making things happen in our world. We find those forces everywhere. And the reason we assume agency out there is because the assumption of the intention of a predator, his intention is to eat me and that's bad, is also good for evolutionary purposes. We're more likely to survive if we make those certain assumptions, and it doesn't cost that much to make that assumption. So it's a good error to make in an evolutionary environment, not so good now, but it doesn't take you out of the gene pool, so we still have that wired into our brains.
Yeah, so there's so much to respond to there. So yeah, you're describing kind of a Pascal's wager, right? I mean, the price of being wrong about the predator being there is low compared to the price of being wrong to not thinking the predator's there. And it's sort of interesting as we talk about patterns too, because there's two ways in which patterns work. One of them is recognizing a pattern and then thinking you know what comes next. And the other is recognizing when a pattern has been disrupted. With the predator, it's really the latter. You know what the wind in the grass sounds like. If you hear something different, if you, the hominid, hear something different, what you're really sort of saying is, this isn't the pattern that I'm used to. Something's wrong here, right?
That's right. So it stands out. So we notice things that are emotionally salient, unusual. This is why we pay close attention to things like shark attacks and terrorist attacks, and it worries us. We fear the wrong things, as psychologists like to say. We don't think about, overeating, diabetes, heart disease, cancer. We worry about the terrorist attack or the shark attack, even though that's a very low probability of causing us any harm. I mean, the number one cause of injury and death for people over 65 is falling. But how many times do you get up in the morning and you think about and worry about falling, right? So our brains are wired up to notice just the most emotionally salient things that stand out, because in a natural environment, that those kinds of things would have really mattered. But in today's world, we're not good at making those probabilistic calculations, which, again, back to the gambling example, is why we're not good gamblers. And you actually have to sort of cheat the system to really win card counting or whatever, because our natural instinct about probabilities, estimating risks, for example. We're terrible at estimating risks. And so our intuitions like that are not good.
So there's a condition called apophenia, where you are seeing patterns where there are no patterns. And one of the things that you point out is that this – I mean, you mentioned dopamine before, that we're actually – I mean, if you think of the movie Conspiracy Theory with Mel Gibson, he's seeing all kinds of patterns where there aren't any, except that there turns out to be some. But we'll get to that in just a second.
Yeah.
But he's in this really kind of heightened state, right? He's in this almost manic state of excitement, because in fact our wiring is still such that the neurochemicals that are being secreted are saying, "Yeah, that's really good that you're seeing these patterns." But they don't really evaluate whether we're right or not.
Yeah, my friend Jared Diamond calls this constructive paranoia. That is, and he got this idea from studying his friend's Papua New Guinea, a traditional society in which they have to worry about things like trees falling in the night when you pitch your tent underneath it. It's good to be paranoid because even though the probabilities are low, if you sleep under a tree every single night for 1,000 straight nights, the odds are you will be killed by a tree. So being paranoid like that actually has benefits in that kind of environment. Now, where that goes wrong is where you begin finding patterns everywhere. everywhere, you know, that 9/11 was an inside job, and, you know, JFK and the Illuminati and the One World Order and the Trilateral Commission and the, you know, this and that. Pretty soon, everywhere you turn, there's a conspiracy and you don't want to leave your house. And at some point, it becomes, you know, a psychosis. That is, you literally can't leave your house, and that becomes destructive of somebody's life. So so the question is, what's the right amount of paranoia? You want enough that you look both ways before you cross the street and so on. You want to be a little bit cautious and paranoid, but not too much.
You know, John Briggs, that, by the way, you should read the emails I get. I mean, I hear from these people. But anyway, John Briggs, it seems as though if you look at sort of modern culture, since you're a professor of English, it seems as though this idea has persisted but transmuted. So you look at the works of Thomas Pynchon and David Foster Wallace. You look at a popular thriller like 3 Days of the Condor. What happens there is the character who wound up being played by Robert Redford, he sees a pattern that nobody else sees. William Gibson has a novel called Pattern Recognition, the same thing. There's a sense that, you know, that we're still in a way exactly where Michael Shermer describes us thousands of years ago on the grasslands, in the sense anyway that you can be as crazy as Mel Gibson is in conspiracy theory or in real life for that matter, but all you have to be is right once, right? If you see a pattern that nobody else sees and it's a real pattern, that in fact, our culture is telling us you ought to still be thinking that way.
Our culture amplifies those kinds of paranoid patterns, so that we get more and more of them. They have a greater strength, I think, than they would have in the past. And we have kind of a cultural psychosis. The 9/11 conspiracies and those other conspiracies that you mentioned are rampant. The media keeps them alive and recycles them. So there's something about the pattern paranoia that gets reinforced by the feedback that comes from the culture at large.
But, you know, Michael Shermer, that argues for looking for some kind of sweet spot, right? Some kind of sweet spot between the kind of paralyzing overconnection that somebody with apophenia, somebody who can become housebound by this, can make, and a kind of agnosticism about patterns. I mean, the reality is there are patterns. We're going to be talking about behavioral patterns in the next segment. We're going to be talking about fractal patterns in nature and art in the final segment. That in a way, an agnosticism about patterns makes us the dumbest hominid on the modern grasslands, the person who just is not going to see the missile coming when it comes.
Correct, right. So, I mean, one question, why can't the hominid just sit there in the grass and collect more data to determine whether it's just the wind or a dangerous predator? And the answer is because that too will make you lunch. That too will take you out of the gene pool, because predators don't wait around for prey animals to collect more data about them. That's why predators are stealthy. That's why they stalk their prey. That's why they're camouflaged. And so you have to make the assumption that patterns are real. You simply do. And the question is which patterns are real and which are not. And until the invention of science, just in the last couple centuries, we had no reliable method of determining which patterns are true or false. But that's what science is all about. I mean, is global warming real or isn't it? Well, in principle, we can answer that question by looking at the patterns in the tree rings, the patterns in the ice core, the patterns in weather data, and so forth, and then run these models and see which ones are correct. And all of science is about pattern recognition. The determination of which patterns are real and which aren't. Is the economy doing this or that? That's a pattern. And science is the best tool we have. Our instincts, our intuitions are just not good enough to get it right often enough that we need in the modern world. And so that's why we need science.
Our instincts include a lot of things that are frankly irrational, Michael Shermer. I mean, you talk about the fact that we actually have an instinct to see faces in things that don't have faces, right?
Yes, right. The Virgin Mary on the side of a building or on a grilled cheese sandwich that sold for $28,000 on eBay. I mean, these kinds of things that, you know, we laugh at, but a lot of people take them very seriously if they have linkages to, you know, spiritual or religious type beliefs. And again, people are very moved by these kinds of experiences of, you know, going out in the woods and you see a waterfall or you hear a voice or something something like this, it moves people dramatically. Even, you know, professional scientists, super rational people, super smart, educated, and so on, they'll have a personal experience that changes their life. And they, even though they recognize, a lot of them have write me and they say, I read your book, but this thing happened to me, and I don't think it fits the explanations you provide by, you know, neurochemistry or, you know, these sorts of brain anomalies that everybody has. Mine was different than those. Of course, every anomalous experience is by definition different and unique to that person. But the question is it real? I mean, it's real inside the person's head. The experience is real that people have. But the question is, does the experience represent something out in the world or inside the mind? And so in often these cases that I write about, they're inside the mind. I don't deny that people have real experiences that moves them and changes their life. You know, they become a different person because of this experience. But as, from a scientist's perspective, we want to know, but is it real? I mean, is it really out there in the world?
All right, we're going to take a little break. We're going to now expand this conversation. John Briggs and Michael Shermer will stay with us, but we're going to expand this conversation to talk about human behavior, patterns in human behavior. All right, we're back. And joining us also now, John Briggs and Michael Shermer still with us, Dr. John Amoroso, a clinical psychologist and mental health instructor at Atlantic University in Virginia. He's the author of Awakening Past Lives. We're going to be talking a bit now about how to apply that kind of pattern seeking and pattern recognizing behavior to human behavior. And I mean, there's sort of a long history of this, and now with the advent of chaos theory, there are new iterations of this. But John Amoroso, I don't know, put a big frame around this for us. How repetitious are you know? There's an old joke. There's a famous old joke about two old men who sit on a porch in a small town, and they have the same argument every single day. One of them says that it's just one thing after another, and the other one says it's the same old thing day after day. So the pattern argument would be it's the same old thing day after day, that people's patterns make their behavior predictable and recognizable. How much do you buy into that?
Well, to a great extent, Colin. one way to look at this is that we form behavioral patterns in the normal course of life, usually focused on simplifying our routines for the day. We get up in the morning at 6, make coffee, have breakfast, wake up the children, take them to school, go to work. These are our general behavioral patterns focused on eliminating chaos, basically, and making life easier. And ultimately, at an extreme version, they're around surviving and developing through the process of life. We even know that these patterns, as we create behavioral patterns, we form neurological networks. Michael maybe can speak to this as well, that light up and engage us in our patterns. And we form unique patterns in a positive way throughout the course of the day. But there is such a thing as, and this is really, I mentioned this in my book, and it's really an extension of the work of Carl Jung. We also form negative patterns or complexes as a result or a reaction to challenging or threatening or traumatic experiences as we go through life. As a result of this, our natural tendency is to create defensive reactions to, again, eliminate the chaos and you know, in a protective way.
Give us an example of this.
Well, a good example is probably Ben, who's in my book, who grew up in a pretty traumatic childhood. He was the youngest of siblings that were 10 years older than him, so he felt abandoned or neglected. His father was an alcoholic, and at the age of 12, his mother was diagnosed with cancer, and within a year and a half, she died. So Ben basically is forming an abandonment complex. And with that are certain reactive behaviors, basically, that help to form basically Ben's personality. So consequently, Ben grows into adulthood and engages in relationships. And when I started to see him in therapy, he was engaged and coming in and saying, you know, my fiance, I feel like is going to abandon me. Well, he was projecting that on her. He was hypersensitive to the idea of being abandoned. And in prior relationships, he did attract people that did abandon him, neglect him, or cheat on him. So it gets a little complicated in terms of the defensive reactions, but Ben was hypersensitive to being abandoned.
Right. So that's I'm going to just stop you here so we can kind of analyze this a little bit. So Michael Shermer, in the first segment, we talked about this thing in terms of cost. All right. So there's under certain circumstances, there's a high cost of ignoring a pattern or a shift in pattern, a low cost of believing in the significance of that. So that's what works for the hominid on the grasslands who thinks he may or may not hear a lion coming. Now, here we're looking at a really high cost to Ben because he thinks he's detected a pattern in human affairs. And this pattern is not to trust intimacy, not to believe in relationships, to see the worm in every apple, to see really a predator in the grass every time he enters a relationship. And he's layering onto it something that we also haven't talked about so far, which is a self-fulfilling prophecy, right? Now that he's seen this pattern, he's going to create this pattern over and over.
Right. So, the fact is no relationship is guaranteed. There is always the possibility your significant other or spouse could cheat on you. Excuse me. Rates of infidelity are just high enough that it does require some effort to what's called mate guarding, just to, you know, make sure that your spouse or partner is taken good care of, that they know that they're loved. In fact, you know what you call love without evidence? Stalking. This is Tim Minchin's little joke, but there's a lot behind that. I mean, if you are giving love to somebody who doesn't give it back, that is stalking. And you do look for signs of affection from your spouse, your partner, your significant other, because if signs don't come back, you should be a little paranoid. Like, I wonder if there's a problem. Maybe something's not quite right. And there's good reasons for that. And you know, we know from DNA studies now that somewhere between 3% and 6% of babies in a maternity ward do not belong to the guy who's standing there. So there's just enough cuckolding that goes on that, people do need to pay attention. You do need to take care of your relationships and nourish them because there is that risk. So again, the person Ben takes us too far, obviously. There's a balance there. There's always that balance.
So, John Briggs, I think we think of human agency and the human factor, the human element. That's almost synonymous with the introduction of chaos, right? That the human factor means, well, yes, you can set up this system that you think is sort of orderly, but once you introduce human beings into it who are unpredictable and who have all these qualities that are impulse-driven and complex, your system becomes a lot less predictable. But, you know, with the advent of fractal theory, of nonlinear dynamics, of chaos theory, there's sort of a thinking that, well, no, you know what? We really maybe can look at human behavior, as unpredictable as it is, but see little pieces of order within a kind of a disorderly system. So suddenly you've got people looking at stock market movements and military strategies and outbreaks of war and the rise of cities. You and I were talking before we went on the air today about the fact that this morning I was on a different kind of show talking about the state budget. And I was sort of saying that, legislators, they look at a hospital tax and they think, well, you know, if we tax 5% of hospital revenues and we know that hospital revenues in this state are $1 million, we'll get whatever 5% of $1 million is. I can't do that math right now, but that's what we'll get. Whereas economists look at this and say, no, that's a very small system. That's a butterfly flapping its wings. And there's a lot of other things that will happen if you do that. But we can measure those things.
Well, measure in the collective sense. One of the problems is that you can't You can't measure very well what a particular individual is going to do. You may know some of his habits, but if that individual operates creatively and is being influenced by other individuals, the predictability goes down pretty quickly. On a grand scale, on a collective level, you can see patterns, but on the individual level, it's harder to detect. And one of the things I think it's important to emphasize is, in the case of Ben and as we were talking earlier, if you're simply relying on the pattern as a stereotype, so that you are responding to it as Ben did, every time you have a relationship, you impose that pattern and presume that it's going to end up badly because the person will abandon you. You may even get to the point of, if the person doesn't abandon you, you kick them so that they do abandon you. That's called projective identification, I think, John. so one of the problems is we have a theory of mind that we're always trying to, and it's a good thing, we're trying to figure out. We know the other person has a mind. And operates in something like the way that we do, and we're trying to predict what that is. People like legislators, if they're good legislators, understand that certain patterns are creative, and they remain flexible. So they look for patterns. If they don't find them, they push on, and eventually something emerges out of that. Chaotic movement, if you will, a dynamic movement that takes place. So that if we want to respond to the world only in terms of stereotypical patterns and rigid patterns, we're in for trouble. If we're more open, then we may be able to move away from the sound that we heard in the bushes, so that we won't get jumped on if it turns out to be a tiger, and look back and see the wind and maybe even appreciate the wind and write a poem about it.
All right. So, Michael Shermer, we talk about patterns. John Amoroso is talking about patterns in kind of a negative way. But we also know there's this gigantic industry in America and elsewhere that thrives on the notion that there are detectable patterns which lead to success in life. So the entire career of Tony Robbins is based on this. And a guy like Stephen Covey, who did The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, we could substitute the word patterns for habits here. You do the same things over and over again. You do them the same way. These things are positive things, we are told, and not in the magical thinking way of Wade Boggs imagining that if he eats chicken every day, he's going to get a hit. Okay, that's a superstition. It doesn't really make any sense. It's just a weird attempt to control reality in the way that you talked about in the first segment. But as many bad patterns as we can see, there's this huge industry peddling the idea that there are good patterns, and if you get into these good patterns, you're going to be okay. You're going to be great. How much stock do you put in that?
Not much. Most of those programs have not been tested empirically. They are anecdotal in nature. They are subject to the confirmation bias and the hindsight bias. Confirmation bias is once you have a hypothesis or idea, you then look for and find confirming evidence to support it, and you ignore the disconfirming evidence. What about all the successful people that didn't have those habits? Covey didn't study those. He only started off with a small set of people that were successful, looked through to find what characteristics of their personality and their behaviors and their life history made them that way. But of course, what about the people he didn't study? And what about the people that had different habits that were successful? What about the people that had those habits who failed? It's a little bit like Malcolm Gladwell's book, Outliers. The Beatles put in 10,000 hours, the 10,000 hour rule, and so forth. Well, what about all the rock bands that put in 20,000 hours and they still stink? What about the, one hit wonders? And there's so many exceptions to these rules. And, these books that find – they start off with companies. Like they take 10 companies and they follow their stock – the stock success over the course of a decade or whatever, but they're ignoring, you know, all the other companies that were that had the same kind of profiles or same management styles or whatever who didn't succeed. And so these things are really, really difficult to test. Social scientists specialize in these things with complex statistical modeling to try to control for intervening variables. And none of those self-help books by Tony Robbins or Covey or any of those have ever done anything like that to try to find the real patterns. And so I don't put much stock in those. I mean, there's some basic things like, you know, you should set goals and write them down and, you know, things like that. Yeah, of course. But social scientists do study things like what makes people happy or, you know, self-satisfaction. And there are a handful of patterns that turn out to be true, like meaningful work, having family or loving relationships, having some kind of goals in life, you know, beyond just work, you know, doing something fulfilling, working for a nonprofit or, you know, trying to help your local community. These are the kinds of things that in these huge statistical bases that they have, in which they do control for all those other variables, turn out to be true. So there are real patterns. They're just really difficult to find and to control for those confirmation bias and the hindsight bias and so on.
Or maybe they're really easy to find. You know, Warren Buffett says you're not smart enough to really figure out the stock market and be a stock picker, and you're not going to be good. The average person is best advised to put their money in an index fund, and then you know, based on everything that we know about 30-year increments or something, your money's going to be fine. It's going to maybe go up and down, but we know in terms of looking at a larger system, you'll be okay. So John Amoroso, in a way, what Michael Shermer just said is sort of the emotional and life equivalent of the difference between being a day trader, trying to make a lot of sharp, shifty moves that are going to work out okay, and doing something that has kind of longitudinal promise. Have a job that you really like, belong to a community, you can do these sort of basic minimum daily emotional requirements that seem over time to bear fruit, even if they're kind of boring to talk about. So, I mean, an awful lot of psychology and psychotherapy does seem to be substituting a positive pattern for the negative pattern that you began our conversation discussing. You've got Ben. He's just basically piling on to the pattern that he saw earlier in his life. Is it possible to give Ben or anybody else a different pattern to follow?
Well, Michael's making an important point, and this is a good question, Colin. In my approach in therapy, and it's interesting because Carl Jung just started to explore the idea of negative complexes and never got into the idea of positive complexes. But, you know, on an individual basis, as we grow up, we have these challenging or traumatic experiences that can form through defensive reactions into negative complexes that and patterns that we deal with throughout life, like Ben. But we also grow up with activating, enlivening positive experiences, and they're unique to each of us. You know, they can have to do with skills or abilities or ways of being in the world, and that's where we feel enlivened or adequate as opposed to inadequate. And the reason I agree with Michael is that in working with individuals, we have to pay attention to their personalities. And the idea in all the trainings I've done with professional psychologists and so forth and with my clients is to activate the positive and de-energize the negative. I do that through the technique of integrated imagery that I use. But it's critical to explore the mechanism of these positive complexes and skills and abilities. And then it's about pursuing, you know, turning that into pursuing a passion in life or an interest or a skill or a career or even a hobby. But it's bringing to the surface the positive and, you know, as I said, de-energizing that negative.
All right, we're going to have to take a quick break here. Thanks to John Amoroso. We're going to move on to – we really have to talk a little bit more about chaos theory, complexity theory. We'll do that after this break.
Impaled on my wall, my eyes can dimly see the pattern of my life and the puzzle that is me.
We'll be right back. I see how it is now. Using modern statistical analysis, I can prove that every global disaster of the last 6 years occurred 5 minutes after someone purchased a Justin Bieber recording. Today's show was produced by Josh Nalea and me, Kyone Wolf. Our interns are Alex Dubin, Hilary St. Germain, and Allison Ehrenreich. Greg Hill appeared in the intro and tweets for us at WNPR Colin, and the part of Bill Curry was played by William Gibson. For show pages, articles, and videos of the Faith Middleton show staff attempting to record the scream of a melting snowflake, visit our website, wnpr.org/Colin. On tomorrow's show, our salute to dragons. And now, back to Colin.
That's right. We're living in an age of dragons these days, from the Hobbit movies to Game of Thrones to How to Train Your Dragon. We'll talk about what these archetypes mean. They don't always mean the same thing, too. Anyway, that's tomorrow. Right now, we're talking about patterns. And I want to sort of move into the area of chaos theory because, you know, we've been talking right now to John Briggs and Michael Shermer. Michael Shermer, science writer, historian, and founder of the Skeptic Society, is the author of a dozen books, including the New York Times best-selling The Believing Brain. John Briggs is in studio with me. He's a professor in the English department at Western Connecticut State University, the author of Fractals, The Patterns of Chaos, and The Turbulent Mirror. There isn't really time to talk about the entire structure of knowledge, but John Briggs, we moved from a time of kind of Cartesian and Newtonian relative certainties into this much more chaotic view of the universe, in which we realize that controlled experiments, you write this in one of your books, the controlled experiments are kind of in almost a joke in a way, in the sense that life and nature are rarely controlled. There's a lot of entropy. There's a lot of variation in input. But one of the things that chaos theory seemed to discover is that within that disorder, there were these windows of order, right? That even given how much entropy there is, how much disorder, how much every system tends to deteriorate, there were ways in which you could find these pockets of order that looked almost Newtonian.
By the way, dragons are one of the ancient symbols for chaos.
There you go. So, all of our shows are connected.
There you go. let me clarify a little bit, as I was saying to you earlier. We have at least three kinds of chaos. One is what people usually consider to be their life. And secondly, we have the randomized chaos that's referred to as entropy, which is an ultimately low-energy situation. And then we have far from equilibrium state of high energy, in which it becomes difficult, if not probably impossible, to predict in detail what the system is going to do. And that's a chaotic system, and it's sometimes considered a boundary area because a boundary between order and total random activity. Because of the high energy, it will sometimes give birth to forms, to regular ordered forms. So I was just in southern Utah hiking in canyon country, which is formed by chaos, is full of what are called fractals. Fractals are the marks and signs of chaotic activity. So one of the things to keep in mind is that when we're talking about chaos, we're talking about very complex systems. They're dynamical systems in which one thing is affecting another through positive feedback loops, which sort of spin out of control, and negative feedback loops, which are more regulatory. The weather is usually the example that's given and is most familiar to people. If you think about weather forecasting and how difficult that is, you see the forecaster using many, many extremely complicated models to try to predict where the hurricane is going to go. The weather is a classic dynamical system. It has many, many moving parts. In fact, in some sense, it's one is sort of misspeaking even to refer to it as parts. You got wind speed, you got temperature, you got pressure. All those things are changing constantly. And one of the things that was discovered, the main thing that was discovered back in the 1960s, was that when you have a weather system, the assumption had been that the more data points you had, the more weather stations you had, the better your information about what was going on at the present, the better would be your long-term forecasting prediction. And it was discovered, in fact, that wasn't the case, that you can get better weather prediction over a short haul, but the system is so dynamic and so volatile that a butterfly flapping its wings in Brazil can change the weather in New York, as the adage goes.
You know, Michael Shermer, as we look at these things, that we look at iterative fractals where it seems as though from a pretty random process, you see these repetitions of patterns where, in fact, within a larger structure, there's a pattern of smaller structures that look like the larger structure, and maybe even a pattern of smaller than that structures that look like the second largest structure. People experiment with things like Sierpinski triangles, where the random roll of a dice begins to create that same kind of fractal pattern. And so in the way that we talked about at the beginning of the show, there is a tendency to say, wow, you know, if in fact when we try to make something random, it seems to revert towards order, then, you know, maybe that's an argument for intelligent design. Maybe there's some master force in the universe that's making these uncanny shapes and patterns emerge again and again. You, as a skeptic, obviously have to find some way of unhorsing that idea.
Indeed. Well, one of the things our brains are not good at is detecting randomness, because randomness doesn't really look random to our brain. So if you show subjects, for example, a series of heads and tails of a coin flip model for, you know, several hundred flips, it doesn't look random, because what you see is, you know, heads, tails, heads, 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 tails, 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 heads, 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 tails. You know, there's long streaks, and this is one of the mistakes gamblers make. They think, well, what are the chances of my losing, you know, seven times in a row if I place a bet on red or black at the roulette table? Actually, chances are pretty good you're going to lose your money, because it doesn't go heads, tails, red, black, like we think intuitively. And in fact, if you ask subjects to write down what they think would be a random series of coin flips, they will write something like heads, tails. It doesn't look like that. So it's very hard for us to detect real randomness in nature, because randomness is clumpy. And it's that clumpiness that actually ends up leading to structure, whether it's gravitational clumpiness of atoms forming a solar system through a condensing cloud of interstellar gas, or weather systems described earlier, and so on. It turns out that there's two effects that I like in chaos theory, path dependency and the initial conditions. So let's say you decide to go to this college instead of that college, and it turns out at the one you chose, you met your future spouse and you have kids, you end up living in the city, you end up working at this particular company, and your life turned out a certain way. But had you gone to this other college, you would have met somebody else and married somebody different, and so on. It would have been a completely different life trajectory. But either one, when you're done, when you look back, you write your memoirs or whatever, it feels like it was inevitable. Like, boy, I made the right choice. Had I not made that choice, then I wouldn't have met this person. I wouldn't have got that job. This would have never happened to me. But that's going to be the case no matter which decision you make. So in terms of decision making about life outcomes, often it doesn't really matter because, however it turns out, with the hindsight bias in full gear, you will find a way to string it all together in a causal sequence that seems not only plausible but inevitable, deterministic, fatalistic, almost like, you know, it was our destiny to meet, as couples often say. And it feels like that to our brains, almost as if there's a God or a fate out there kind of directing things, even though that does not appear to be the case.
We have to stop. I dare not ask another question. I've only got about 60 seconds left. I will say that one of the things I'd really hoped to get to, we just ran out of time though, John Briggs has some very interesting things to say about what happens when you try to be random. It's actually sort of harder than you think. Jackson Pollock trying to create a randomness in his paintings, and it turns out there are fractal patterns that show up there against his best intentions. Anyway, we'll have to save that for another day. Thanks to Josh Nalea. This show was his idea. He brought it into being. Thanks to Kyan Wolf on the board. There too. And get ready for a show about dragons tomorrow.
Everywhere we see them there, we stop and stare at patterns. We don't care, we must be clear, we've got a flair for patterns. On our hair, their clothes, we wear our style, up there is patterns. All we see is patterns, the patterns that repeat.
Wallpapers, skyscrapers, funny papers, patterns. Evergreens, Nouvelle cuisine, human beings, patterns. Wedding cakes, rattlesnakes, patterns, golden wheat, little feet, my heart.
Okay, Doc. What's my diagnosis?
I'm afraid you have patternicity.
I'm sorry, what?
I'm afraid you have patternicity.
Say again.
I'm afraid you have patternicity.
I don't believe it, for once.